I've had a couple people this week email me the latest WWJD thing. Have you seen that?
About the driving?
Yeah, what would Jesus drive?
Actually, wouldn't be an SUV. I had to tell Michelle while I was sleeping last night, and I heard on the news, I wasn't going, am I hearing that?
What would Jesus drive? But of course, the first thing I said to my wife was, what would Jesus drive? A donkey.
Yeah, really, that's
and I'm guessing that none of these people who are complaining, carrying their signs, but none of them are riding horseback over here. Yeah.
I'm not getting rid of my expedition.
Why do you think they're getting all that press, though?
Well, it started last year.
Because it's a liberal
did it?
Media.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes, and the liberal media is trying to
Gain greater control
and make Christians look
crazy.
Exactly. And it's, you know, anytime they can find a lunatic Christian, they'll put them right on the news as fast as they can because it shows that Christians are inherently dumb.
Mm-hmm.
So. All right, we're in Daniel 11. And as I recall, the place where we left off, I was going through history in advance here. And the place where we left off, I had told you that the king of the north and the king of the south, Ptolemy, the king of the south, and Seleucus Nicator, the king of the north, had joined forces against Antigonus and had pushed Antigonus out of that Middle Eastern area, which then Seleucus Nicator took over, officially designating Seleucus Nicator as the king of the north. So from this point forward, starting at like verse 5 of Daniel 11, from this point forward, every time you see king of the north and king of the south, you're either talking about descendants, well, you are talking about descendants of Seleucus Nicator's empire, the king of the north, or Ptolemy's empire, king of the south. So think Turkey, southern Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Transjordan, the northern portions of Palestine. Think of that as being king of the north. And then every time you see king of the south, you're talking about Gaza and Egypt. Got it? Now Daniel's going to continue to tell us history in advance, starting at verse 5. I think that's where we left off. And the king of the south shall be strong, and one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. That's where we left off last week, right? Does that sound familiar? Everybody know what happened there? That's when the two joined forces and pushed Antigonus out of the way. So that takes us to verse 6. And in the end of years, they shall join themselves together. For the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her to these times. Now that sounds all very cryptic, doesn't it? If you just looked at that, you'd have no idea what that meant until you look at exactly the history that took place between the king of the north and the king of the south. Here's what actually happened, and then you'll see that Daniel was just dead on right. Years passed, kings died, new kings arose, and the king of the south decided that intermarriage would be politically expedient, but there was a problem. The king of the north was already married. So Ptolemy II Philadelphia, who ruled from 285 to 246 BC, had a daughter named Berenice. And he insisted that the king of the north, Antiochus II, who called himself Antiochus Theos, I am God, there's a nice name. Antiochus II Theos, who ruled from 261 to 246 BC, the king of the south insisted that he put away his current wife, whose name was Laodicea, and that he enter into this political union with his own daughter. Got the picture? So the king of the south wants to make a pact with the king of the north, but the king of the north is already married. So he says, why don't you get rid of that wife and marry my daughter, and then we'll have a union of power between us. However, within a few years of that marriage, which did take place, Ptolemy II died. And once he was dead, Antiochus decided to put away Berenice, who he had never really loved, who he had entered into a political union with, and he decided to take Laodice, his original wife, back. But she was not that easily appeased. Typical of a woman, said, oh yeah, put me away for another woman and then bring me back. So she murdered her husband, and then she murdered his Egyptian wife, And she murdered the infant son of Antiochus and Berenice. So sure enough, just like Daniel said, Berenice was given up, her father had died, her husband and her son were killed. Precisely as Daniel had said. He said, she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengthened her to these times. Every one of them died. But, verse 7, but out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate. The her here references the daughter of the king of the south, the one who was killed, the one who was the subject of the end of verse 6, when it said that she would not stand in the power of the arm, neither would he stand nor his arm. She would be given up. They that brought her would be given up. The her there is the daughter of the king of the south. So now we're talking about the king of the south again. But out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, which shall come with an army and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north and shall deal against them and shall prevail and shall also carry captives into Egypt with their gods, with their princes, and with their precious vessels of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return to his own land. Now there's another place where we can check Daniel now. That's a very specific bit of information, that the king of the south then, who has to be related to Berenice, who was killed up in the north, is going to enter in, take them captive, take the princes, take the gold, and this is all going to happen on the heels of Berenice dying. Another place we can check Daniel. If that doesn't happen, Daniel's wrong. So here's exactly what happened. Berenice's brother, who ruled from 246 to 221 BC, who is referred to as a branch of her roots, a brother coming out of the same roots, he was now upset at how his family had been treated, so he prevailed militarily against the new king of the north, who was Laodice's son, Seleucus Callinicus, who ruled from 247 to 226 BC. He, Seleucus Callinicus, when he saw the army coming, fled and hid behind the Taurus Mountains, while this Euergetes carried off princes as hostages, ransacked their gold, silver, and all their idols. Verse 9, meanwhile, might be better rendered, and he shall come into the realm of the king of the south, but he shall return into his own land. And that's the way, if you have an ASV or an RSV, that's the way that it's rendered, because the actor in the verse is the king of the north, who was the subject of the end of verse 8. Later, in about 240 BC, Seleucus mounted a return attack on Egypt, but he was defeated completely, and he was forced, just like Daniel said, to return into his own land. Now, I know that's a lot of details to remember, and I don't expect your notes to reflect everything I'm saying here, but what you got to know is so far Daniel's batting a thousand here. He hasn't missed on anything, and he's talking about things that are going to happen hundreds of years in the future to him, and they're continuing to happen exactly as he said. Verse 10, but his sons shall be stirred up and shall assemble a multitude of great force, and one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up, even to his fortress. That's pretty cryptic. You're not going to know what that means until you take a look at the history. The sons of Seleucus, sure enough, rose up after Antiochus Theos had been killed, and Seleucus Callinicus had been routed by Egypt. So Seleucus III, from 226 to 223 BC, he only ruled for 3 years. Seleucus III had perished in a battle in Asia Minor. He was succeeded by Antiochus III Magnus, which means Antiochus is great. Antiochus the Great was successful in carrying out several campaigns against Egypt. And because the Egyptian ruler of the time, who was Ptolemy Philopater, who ruled from 221 to 203 BC, because he was largely indolent, Antiochus restored to Syria all the territory as far south as Gaza. In other words, successions of kings. All you've got to see here is this succession of kings. Northern and southern kings, northern and southern kings. Some who ruled for 30 years, some who ruled for 3 years. And they kept fighting back and forth, back and forth. And Daniel told in advance how all the battles were going to go. Who was going to win, who was going to rise up, who was going to do what. And he was right every single time. Verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with anger, and shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. Here's what actually happened in history. The movement of Syrian armies that close to the Egyptian border, all the way down into Gaza, finally inspired the southern king to take action. He raised an army of 75,000 men. Antiochus brought 78,000 men to do battle at Raphia. The Egyptian army was directed by Ptolemy, who, by the way, was accompanied by his wife, who was also his sister, named Arsinoe. And the ensuing battle resulted in a complete victory for Egypt. And as Antiochus lost his entire army and was almost captured, he fled into the desert. Now, again, Daniel wrote hundreds of years in advance that the king of the south was going to be moved with anger. That's what happened. He'd come forth and fight with the king of the north, that he would bring a great multitude. It's exactly what happened. And the multitude would be given into his hands. Exactly what happened. Daniel was 100% right. And when he had taken away his multitude, this is verse 12, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. I'm intrigued by that comment, but he shall not be strengthened by it. Because that's exactly what happened to Ptolemy, the king of the south. He was a largely indolent, overfed, inbred guy who, even though he was winning and had good armies, never took advantage of the multiple victories he had because he was too busy being the big, fat, lazy king. True to his indolent nature, when he had rousted the northern armies, Ptolemy sat on his good fortune rather than occupying the territories that he had won and taking advantage of that victory. So he returned to his home, and Antiochus, meanwhile, started rebuilding. Verse 13 says, "For the king of the north shall return, and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years with a great army and with much riches." Now, one more time, if in that previous battle where the 75,000 and the 78,000 met, if Antiochus hadn't fled, none of what Daniel's saying here could have been true. But sure enough, he was kept alive. He fled and he came back with a bigger army. How did Daniel know these things? In the period between 212 and 204 BC, Antiochus advanced east to the borders of India and as far north as the Caspian Sea. Ptolemy Philopater and his queen died mysteriously in 203 BC, and they were succeeded by their infant son, Ptolemy V Epiphanes. In 208 BC, Antiochus assembled another great army and turned his attention toward Egypt. Now that Philopater's dead, and now that the king is just an infant, just a kid, perfect time to go attack with the bigger, greater army that he's created. And in those times there shall stand up against the king of the south, this is verse 14, and in those times shall many stand up against the king of the south, and also the robbers of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. Isn't that an odd thing to write? That Daniel called a group of people the robbers of thy people, who he said would exalt themselves to establish the vision. In other words, at this like benchmark, you're going to see these people, the robbers of thy people, and you're going to see them rise up, exalt themselves, and fall. And when you see that, know that that's just all part of the vision coming true. That's so cool that he would write that in there. Like, benchmark this. Check it off. When you see it happen, you know that God is continuing by his sovereign hand to control history. This cryptic bit of detail was fulfilled when a large number of Jews entered into a league with Antiochus the Great, in a league against Egypt. And they participated in his attacks on the garrison that the Egyptian general Scopas had left in the citadel in Jerusalem. But they were defeated. The expression, "the robbers of thy people," is a reference to people who violate law and justice. So they are robbers, or alternately translated, men of violence, which some of your translations will have. But interestingly, the angel announced to Daniel and said that though they were acting of their own initiative and volition, these Jews would nevertheless be establishing the vision, completing this very prophecy, that they would go in, make a league with their enemies, and use that as an advantage to go in and rob the temples in Jerusalem and fail. When the Jewish readers compared those acts of their fellow countrymen to this juncture in history, they should have recognized God's sovereign hand in their affairs and realized that these rebels were most certainly doing that which God had ordained to be done. Interesting that God would just put that benchmark in there. Now, when you see this, you know I'm still in control. So, verse 15 and 16 says, "So the king of the north shall come, cast up a mount, and take the most fenced cities, and the arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, neither shall there be any strength to withstand. But he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him, and he shall stand in the glorious land, which by his hand shall be consumed. That sounds exciting, doesn't it? And these kings, as they were struggling for dominance, a new threat to both of them had begun to emerge in the West, the Roman Empire. Meanwhile, Antiochus III had forced Scopas the general to surrender at a place called Sidon, which was their most fenced city, where they kept all their fortifications for their wars. That victory happened in 198 BC. We're 198 years from the birth of Christ when this stuff is happening now. So Daniel's honing in now on the coming of Christ. And this victory gave Syria dominance over all of Palestine as far south as Gaza. But with the impending threat of Rome hanging over them, Antiochus suddenly realized that he needed a diplomatic settlement with the Egyptian rulers, or else they would both be swept away by Rome. So here's what he did. Verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him, and thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither shall she be for him. You know who that is? Cleopatra. Sure, 200 years before Jesus, the king of the north hands the king of the south, who is, remember, a very young boy, hands him Cleopatra. Wanting to rule over both the Syrian and the Egyptian domains, setting up his own princes and having kingship over them all, Antiochus III the Great gave his daughter Cleopatra to the young king. Ptolemy V Epiphanes in 192 BC was a mere 7 years old, and Antiochus expected that this marriage would ruin his former opponent because she would be the older, more dominant woman who he could work through to control the young king and take over the Egyptian empire. She, by the way, in the Bible, is played by Elizabeth Taylor. But anybody who watched the movie knows that Cleopatra did not stay true to her father, exactly like Daniel predicted. She stood with her husband and suggested instead that they make an alliance with Rome to ensure their own safety. Verse 18 says, after this shall he turn his face upon the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf shall cause the reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own approach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. That's a cryptic thing to say, isn't it? Here's what actually happened. Over in the Macedonian section of the divided Grecian Empire, the Romans had defeated the area of Philip of Macedon on their march eastward. And thinking that he could take advantage of that fact, Antiochus advanced into the Macedonian Thracian area, attempting to conquer some of the islands. Exactly, by the way, as Daniel said he would. Antiochus came into contact with a Roman consul whose name was Lucius Scipio Asiaticus, who is the guy who is referred to here by Daniel as a prince for his own behalf. Antiochus had treated him scornfully at a meeting in Lysimachia, declaring that Asia was no concern of Rome's and that he was not subject to their orders. Well, that's a big reproach to a guy who's a general in the area. You go in and say, we're not going to pay you, we're not going to give you, and this is no concern of yours, I'm taking over this area, we're not going to pay you, go away. That reproach happened to be the downfall, the beginning of the downfall of Antiochus at the hands of Rome. He stirred up Rome, big mistake. Antiochus set out to equal the conquests of Alexander the Great by conquering Greece. He was defeated in 191 BC at Thermopylae, north of Athens. And again, he was defeated in 189 BC at Magnesia on the Meander River, southeast of Ephesus, by soldiers of Rome and Pergamum under the leadership of the Roman general Scipio, the very one that he had offended earlier. Big mistake. Scipio compelled Antiochus to surrender to Rome all of the land that he had west of the Taurus Mountains. Rome also exacted a tax that he would collect from all of his people in order to pay for the wars. So not only did he defeat them in the war, he then made them pay the cost of the war to defeat them. Verse 19. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. That's an interesting phrase. Not going to be killed in war, but going to turn himself toward the fortress of his own land, stumble, fall, not be found. Well, that's exactly what Antiochus III the Great did. Antiochus III really should have gone down in history as being one of the mightiest world conquerors that the Syrian Empire had ever seen. He had had tremendous success and then blew it at the end by messing with Rome. In his last days, defeated by Rome and unable to be content without conquering Greece, Antiochus returned to his own territory a broken man, and he was killed in a religious uprising as he was trying to plunder the Temple of Jove in Elam. Elam, with an M. Temple dedicated to Jove. He goes back to his own land and tries to rout a temple in his own land, causes a religious uprising. They kill him in the streets. Exactly as Daniel said, he'll stumble and fall and not be found. Is that remarkable? How does Daniel know these little tiny details about how a guy will die? Then shall stand up in his estate a raiser of taxes in the glory of the kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. Now there's another one of those places where you can check Daniel out and you can say, okay, now either this is right or wrong. Once Antiochus is dead, the guy behind him has to raise taxes and then has to essentially disappear, but not in war and not in anger. So here's what happened. The next Syrian king was Seleucus IV Philopater. And because of the oppression of taxation by Rome, he imposed the burden of excessive taxation on all the inhabitants of Israel. He assigned a special tax collector named Heliodorus to secure the taxes from the Jews under his domain. Heliodorus was dispatched to plunder the temple, and soon afterwards Seleucus was suddenly and mysteriously poisoned, probably by Heliodorus himself. He was, just like Daniel said, destroyed neither in anger nor in battle. And again, all the secular history books agree that's what happened. But Daniel predicted it. Daniel, again, writing during the Babylonian captivity, 300 years before the fact, 400 years before the fact, he's saying exactly that particular kings are going to come up and die in particular ways, and they do. Now, here's the point. Up until this point, history accurately accounts for everything Daniel writes, right up to that verse. Accurately tells us about the kings that are going to come, they're going to rise, they're going to fall, follows along accurately through history. But exactly at this point in the story, suddenly we have a problem, because history and Daniel disjoint at this point. Everything you read from this point forward becomes history in advance that hasn't happened yet. Remember the first or second week that we were teaching here, I taught you about the gap. Remember the gap? That even Jesus showed the gap in Old Testament prophecy. And if you know where to stick that gap in, there is a time where God said, it's going to go like this, go like this, go like this. And then there's a cutoff point where there's the parenthesis of Christ coming, the inception of the church, and then that gap closes and history picks up again. Well, that's precisely what's happening here. History and prophecy converged perfectly in Daniel's account, but starting at verse 21, history has a dramatic problem. The details that follow don't accurately suit any historic person. And yet, up until verse 20, Daniel didn't miss. Up till verse 20, he was just dead on. Suddenly at verse 21, we have a problem. Still, there is considerable confusion, and some scholars have imposed a person that they contend is the fulfillment of the rest of this chapter. And he is, historically, the next successor in the lineage of the kings of the north. If you're following the kings of the north, and you've heard several kings now be named Antiochus, then you're probably familiar with Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus IV in a row, Antiochus IV Epiphanes. If you are familiar at all with amillennial theology or amillennial approaches to Old Testament prophecy, particularly Daniel, they will say that Antiochus Epiphanes is the fulfillment of the rest of Daniel, because he is the next historic person to come along in line. The problem is what Daniel says and what Antiochus did don't fit. So we have a problem. Plus, if Antiochus is the little horn that Daniel was talking about, then it makes no sense for Jesus to mention Daniel and the little horn as future to him, which we're going to look at in the weeks coming up. So Antiochus simply cannot be the fulfillment of the little horn prophecy. But there are lots of folks who want to make him that. Probably more than any other historic character, Antiochus Epiphanes is pointed to as the fulfillment and the embodiment of Daniel's little horn. However, the details of Antiochus' career do not match the details of Daniel's prophecy. The most legitimate heir to rulership would have been Demetrius, who was the young son of his brother, Seleucus IV. There was also a younger son of Seleucus IV, also by the name of Antiochus, who was still a baby in Syria. Antiochus IV, the brother of Seleucus IV, was in Athens when his brother died. When he received word that Heliodorus had murdered his brother Seleucus, he posed as the guardian for young Antiochus, who was in Syria. But through intrigue, he managed to secure the Syrian throne for himself. Young Antiochus was murdered by Andronicus, whom Antiochus IV then killed. And thus began the reign of one of the Middle East's most wicked rulers. And from 175 to 164 BC, Antiochus IV Epiphanes earned a place of infamy in Jewish history. Anybody here familiar with the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees? Apocryphal books?
Yeah. That's when he
that's who it's about.
Yeah, and so, he did the slaying the pig and...
Right, in the and used the pig blood to go in and desecrate the temple.
Right.
Absolutely. And in fact, coming up here in December, Hanukkah's coming up, the Festival of Lights, which is a commemoration of the War of the Maccabees and the story, the legend, that the oil inside the temple, they had to go in, the priests had to go in and keep the oil in the lamps and keep the lamps always lit. But during the time that Antiochus raided Jerusalem and the Maccabees fled into the wilderness and assembled an army and came back and the fights and the wars that went on, the Jewish wars of that period, during that time they say that the light never went out inside the temple and that God mysteriously continued the oil in the lamps so that the light in the temple never went out, and that's what Hanukkah is a commemoration of, the Festival of Lights. The books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, intertestamental chronicles considered by Jews and Protestants as apocryphal or not inspired books, are the historic accounts of the Maccabean rebellion against the terror of Antiochus Epiphanes. This is of utmost importance in understanding how Antiochus IV has come to be confused with Daniel's little horn. Catholic scholarship and liberal higher textual criticism has concluded that the book of Daniel is a forgery, not to be considered as genuine prophecy, but rather it's to be considered as written to inspire Jews during the occupation of Jerusalem by this Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, I meant to bring you my Catholic New American Bible tonight, but I forgot. But nevertheless, in the book that I'm reading from, I've quoted the New American Bible. So here's the quote. In the introduction to the book of Daniel found in the New American Bible, translated by the members of the Catholic Biblical Association of America, sponsored by the Bishops' Committee of the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine, we read this. This is their introduction to the book of Daniel. Before you ever get to read it, they can tell you what you're supposed to think about it. This book takes its name not from the author, who is actually unknown. See right away, it's not Daniel. And it didn't happen during the Babylonian captivity. This book takes its name not from the author, who is actually unknown, but from its hero, a young Jew taken early to Babylon. Strictly speaking, the book does not belong to the prophetic writings. I'm sorry, did we see any prophecy in this book anywhere?
No.
No. We've seen tons of prophecy in this book. How many weeks have we been looking at the prophecies in this book? Catholics say no. It does not belong to prophetic writing, but rather to a distinctive type of literature known as apocalyptic, of which it is a very early specimen. Apocalyptic writing enjoyed its greatest popularity from 200 BC to 100 AD, a time of distress and persecution for Jews and later for Christians. This work was composed during the bitter persecution carried on by Antiochus IV Epiphanes from 167 to 164 BC, and it was written in order to strengthen and comfort the Jewish people during their ordeal. Did you see what they just said? They said the book's a forgery, and all that history I just read you, all the history in advance, even going back to Daniel saying who the next kings were that are going to be coming after the Babylonish, into the Medo-Persian, into the Grecian king, all that stuff. They said the only reason he knew all that is that the book is a fake, that the book of Daniel is a forgery, and that it was written for the purpose of encouraging the Jews during the time that they were being persecuted by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, pray tell me how it is that the Jews, under this conflict with Antiochus Epiphanes, who is destroying their temple and overrunning Jerusalem, killing thousands of Jews, what comfort did they get from, let's say, the image with the golden head and the silver breastplate and the brass sides and the iron leg? What comfort was there in that for them? I don't figure that helped them much at all, did it? Including that there would be a 10-toed kingdom and Christ would come back during the 10-toed kingdom, and that Antiochus never established any 10-nation confederacy or kingdom, and Christ never did come back. So there's very little comfort in that, isn't there? I mean, there's, you know. Huh? Yeah, well, the point is what they want to do is just dismiss the book and then assume you won't read it. Having dismissed it as a forgery that only applied to the Jews of that period, then there's really no reason for a 20th century Christian to read the book. But we've been reading it now for weeks and weeks on end, and it's been very helpful in our Christianity, hasn't it? And they say, well, just don't look. Just don't read it. Nah.
Plus, the people in the 2nd century B.C. would know it was a lie and wouldn't provide much comfort, haven't
they? Isn't that the point? Is that they know it's a forgery, they know it's a lie, they don't consider it part of their scripture, and more importantly, Jesus comes along later and quotes it and calls Daniel the prophet. Now, wouldn't Jesus have known if it was a forgery? Wouldn't he know that he was quoting a lie? Exactly. The confraternity of Catholic bishops let him know it was a lie, but they weren't around to tell him, and he made the mistake of calling it.
It was a real good forgery.
It was just a really good forgery.
Even fool
Jesus. What a surprise. Yeah, I mean, it makes no sense at all. But with that sweeping, unsubstantiated generality, the Catholic interpreters do away with Daniel's phenomenal accuracy in foretelling the history of the Middle Eastern world, and in so doing, they find fulfillment for the entire account in the person and reign of Antiochus Epiphanes. Unfortunately, this is very anti-biblical. This interpretation enjoys a wide audience in our confessing evangelical circles, and it is the linchpin of amillennial and postmillennial and sometimes historic premillennial theology. And yet it comes straight out of Catholic anti-biblical thinking. Antiochus Epiphanes, whose name means glorified, Epiphanes. It's a name Antiochus took to himself in an effort to make himself out to be a deity, broke the back of the Jewish nation by undermining their religious system of worship. He's widely known for having sacrificed a pig, one of the Old Testament unclean animals, on the altar of the temple and spreading the blood on the walls, desecrating the sanctuary. The cleansing and the rededicating of the temple after the Maccabean victory is commemorated each year as the Feast of Purim, or the Feast of Lights, coming up here in December. Inasmuch as Antiochus was the historic successor to the Syrian dynasty, and his short, tumultuous reign did include this attack on the Jewish religion, he's a convenient figure to impose on the following verses. But we have to ask the question, can Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes be the little horn, the Antichrist, the culmination of the demonic rulers who will persecute the Jews? And the answer is, of course, no, he can't be. Primarily because of Jesus setting the little horn out into the future. At best, he is Satan's counterfeit, designed to muddy the waters and confuse the prophecy, but he cannot be the final apostate world ruler whose reign ends with the second appearance of Christ. Christ didn't appear, so he can't be that world ruler. The official Catholic interpretation notwithstanding, he just doesn't fit the details. He loosely resembles some of the activities, but there are far too many holes in the actual history of Antiochus to make him a serious contender for this dubious honor. For instance, in Daniel 8:23, we read, "And in the latter times of their," that's the four generals, "in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance, understanding dark sentences, shall stand up." Does that fit Antiochus? No. Antiochus was not in the latter times of the Grecian Empire. He came to his end more than 100 years before the Grecian Empire fell. Nor are we able to say that 160 years before Christ was even born, that somehow the transgressors are come to the full. That just doesn't fit. You got no place to put that. As well, there are several references stating that the little horn will make war with the Prince of Princes, which is undeniably a reference to Christ. But no such battle can be found in connection with Antiochus. He was gone 160 years before Christ appeared. The Christian religion was utterly unknown during his reign, and it's pointless to attempt spiritualizing these references to imply that Antiochus somehow did do battle with Christ. There's no biblical or exegetical imperative that demands or even allows that kind of interpretation. And yet, I've heard that interpretation over and over and over again by people who won't study the details. And details count. But most convincingly, everybody turn to Matthew 24:15. I'm just about done. Matthew 24, everybody look over there. Once we get through with Daniel and start working our way closer to the book of Revelation, we'll go through Matthew 24 in some detail, since there's a lot of confusion surrounding that area. But here's Jesus speaking. This is Jesus talking 160 years after Antiochus is dead. Actually, it'd be more years because Jesus is 30 by then. 160 BC, it's 190 roughly years after Antiochus is dead. Jesus says, "When you therefore see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet," there's the place where Jesus seems incredibly confused about whether Daniel is a real prophet or a forgery. "When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso that reads, let him understand, then let him which is in Judea flee into the mountains." Now we're going to look at that in more detail coming up, because Daniel's going to tell them where in the mountains to flee, and then the book of Revelation is going to tell them how long to stay there when they're gone. We're looking at all that as it comes up as we continue through Daniel here. But more importantly, Jesus just said that the thing that the little horn is going to do, the sign that the tribulation period has begun for the Jews, the signal for them to get out of Judea and flee to the hills, is something that the little horn is going to do, he said, was still future to him. So Antiochus Epiphanes simply doesn't fulfill it. That one simple fact should be instantly evident. Jesus spoke of this event as future to his first incarnation. As such, any theory concluding that Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes is the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy is patently wrong and must be set aside as unbiblical, lacking both historic and theological scholarship. You know, the confraternity of Catholic bishops notwithstanding. Isn't that really remarkable that they would write stuff like that in their own Bible? They would put that right in their notes? This book is a forgery, knowing that all anybody has to do is go read Matthew, Jesus' own words, and say, why is Jesus quoting a forgery? So Daniel 11 is where we were. Go to Daniel 11. We stopped at verse 21 because I said this is the point at which history and prophecy no longer mesh. So let's take a look at what he says happens. Daniel 11, 21. "And in his estate," this is in Philopater's estate, the last of the Antiochus line, "in his estate shall stand up a vile person, to whom they shall not give the honor of the kingdom, but he shall come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries." That's not what Antiochus did. He came in killing, he came in overrunning, he came in through political intrigue and took over. From verse 20 to 21, we leap over the gap. Daniel's prophecy, without skipping a beat, drew a connecting line from ancient Greece to the last days. Out of the estate of the kings of the north, this final demonic leader will arise. This is perfectly consistent with what we saw with the ram and the he-goat, which said that out of the four generals who ruled in Alexander's domain would come the little horn. And as we narrow the focus in chapter 11, we find that it's exactly out of that area, the Seleucid portion specifically, that the little horn's going to come. Now, are you beginning to get a feel for, when we first started this, I think first or second week, I said, the Antichrist is going to come out of the Middle East. And half the room went, oh, I don't know, where do you get that? I said, stay here, I'll show you where I get that. Do you get it now? Do you see why? Do you see where? Do you see? I mean, it's all over the book of Daniel. Look to the Seleucid portion of the ancient Grecian Empire. That's where the little horn comes from. He has said it now three different times, three different ways. And now he's gone through so much detail to say, here's the history, here's the history, here's the history. And every time he's been exactly right, exactly right, exactly right. Why would he lose here? There's no reason to believe he's going to fail here. Into the details, into the who would get married and who would love who and who would stay and who would die, who'd get poisoned, who'd be killed in battle, who would run off the battlefield and come back with a bigger army. He had all of those details right. And then he says, out of that area, out of Philopater's estate, out of the Seleucid portion of the ancient Grecian Empire will rise up this vile person. Out of that area. So watch that area. You got that? Now let me just give you this. Just as the primary visage of the beast of Revelation 13 was as a leopard. Remember a few weeks ago we looked at this beast in Revelation 13? Remember that when we saw him, he was as a leopard, which likened him or brought him back to the kingdom of Alexander. It's out of one of his general's territories that the final ruler comes. And remember that the leopard had four heads because it was the four generals that would take over in his estate. And then you go to the book of Revelation, and sure enough, when you see the final beast ruler, his visage is as a leopard, taking you back to Greece again. So I don't care if you're in Daniel or if you're in Revelation, it keeps pointing to the Middle East. It keeps sending you back to the Middle East. It's not going to be the EU, and it's not going to be the United Nations. It's going to be out of the Middle East, a 10-nation confederacy united around a world ruler who will take three by force, and then the other seven will give him the power. Daniel told us that the last kingdom would be a loose confederation of 10 kings, three uprooted, and the other seven would give the little horn the power. He will make a peace pact with Israel, reconfirming the covenant to build the temple, and he will come in peaceably and obtain the kingdom by flatteries. Yet look at verse 22 and 23 of Daniel 11. It says, "And with the arms of a flood shall they be overflown from before him, and they shall be broken, yea, also that prince of the covenant. And after the league made with him, he shall work deceitfully, for he shall come up and shall be strong with the small people." That's where we're going to pick up next week. 2 weeks, not next week. Next week's Thanksgiving. In 2 weeks, we're going to pick up right there. We're going to pick up right there. Because now Daniel is going to tell us with equal accuracy all the things he's told us about history. He's now going to give us all this stuff about the Antichrist, what he's going to do, how he's going to act, and we can know going in what he's going to do. Now, there's going to be some things he's going to say that admittedly nobody knows. We're going to go, well, what's that mean? Because it's as cryptic as some of the stuff that we read before. We say, well, what's that mean? And only by putting it next to history can we say, well, oh, history tells us what that meant. Well, because it hasn't happened yet, some of the stuff he's going to say we know is going to be 100% accurate. He's always been 100% accurate. But we don't know yet what it means. We won't know till it happens. The cool part is, I don't know if this is really cool, perhaps the Jews that are here won't think it's cool, but when all this stuff happens, when the church is gone and God turns his attention back to Israel, they don't have to go to the book of Revelation to be convinced, because they're going to continue to say, well, New Testament, all that Jesus stuff, we don't. All they got to do is go to Daniel and start reading in their own scripture, and they're going to see, oh yeah, the reformation of the covenant to rebuild the temple. Well, it says right here that 3.5 years into it, he's going to break that covenant with us. And that's why Jesus is then going to say in Matthew 24, pray that your flight isn't on the Sabbath day. Pray that it's not during the winter, but as soon as you see it start, run. And they got to go to the book of Daniel to find out where to run to. And when they see all that happening, they know for a fact Messiah's coming. And then it says, when he comes back, they will look on him whom they have pierced, and they will weep over him as a mother weeps over her only child. Because they're going to recognize he's back, and look, he didn't come back as some earthly guy. It's him. It's Jesus come back. And that's the beginning of the reformation of Israel and the 144,000 and the regathering of Israel back into their own area under the kingship and the lordship of Jesus. See how this all just kind of fits together? Who'd have thunk it? Oh, so we'll get to all that. Yes, absolutely. They're also Israelites.
Right, right. men.
Right. No, absolutely.
So
Before Jesus comes back.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all I was saying is that the 144,000 is the beginning of the Reformation of Israel and the regathering of Israel. They are the first 144,000 sent out to the 12 tribes, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes going out to preach, yeah, to preach Christ. That's the beginning of the conversion of Israel.
Do you think the people who carries Israel
away
is the United States?
No. No, because it doesn't say an eagle. It just says they'll be carried away as on eagle's wings. In other words, it's a quick movement. It's a swift movement. Except the place that they're carried away to is Edom, Moab, and Ammon, which are in the mountain areas east of Jerusalem. Exactly the place that Daniel is going to say the Antichrist can't get to. Exactly the place that Jesus just told them in Matthew 24 to run to. Exactly the place that Revelation will tell them to stay for 3.5 years. So there's, you know, America doesn't really have to be involved there. But I think that's an attempt by people who want to see America in the Bible somewhere, is they see the word eagle and they go, oh, that's us! You know, well, gosh, God manages to name other countries by name. You know, so. Questions? Other than that one?
How do you think the world's going to go after an Arab as the Antichrist?
Say that again?
I mean, most of the world hates Arabs. So, I mean, what I'm wondering is, how do you think the whole world is going to fall after an Arab and follow him?
Remember a couple of things. First off, all he has to do is create a 10-nation confederacy in the Middle East, and he controls all the oil. And it says that, as we're going to see as we go on in Daniel here, it says that they're all going to sit at the same table and make deals and make pacts and then turn around and break their deals and everything else. It's not that they're going to follow him because they love him. They're going to follow him because he has the power. And then it's going to be a world religious leader, the false prophet.
That he'll be a Jew.
He may be a Jew, he may be the Pope. You know, we'll have to see. And by the way, for those of you watching closely, the next Pope might very well be a Jew. Have you been watching that?
No.
The leading contender for the papacy at this moment is a French cardinal who was born Jewish. And since the current Pope has always wanted to set up his throne once and for all in Jerusalem, but they said, no, you know, the Christians like it, the Jews didn't. If it was a Jewish Pope, you're on. So watch closely. I can't come up with his name. I know his name. So watch that stuff because, yeah, I mean, there's going to be a world religious leader who is going to take this Middle Eastern ruler beyond the realm of just good political guy to worship him the same way that Saddam Hussein wants to be worshipped, the same way that all those Middle Eastern rulers want to be the next prophet, the next Muhammad. Absolutely. They want to be the next Nebuchadnezzar. They want to be the next, not just president. They want to carry the name Epiphanes. They want to be, you know, the deity. They want to be the theos. The other thing is, how did Hitler manage to do what he did? Clearly, there was a more than human power behind him.
Right.
How did, you know, Alexander the Great manage to conquer? Because there was a more than human power behind him. So when you say everybody, you know, the world by and large politically is against Arabs, how will an Arab leader rule? Well, it won't be by his power. You know, so. Anything else? All right. See y'all.